Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. In this episode, I sit down with actor Ted Danson. First known to most as Cheers' charismatic bartender Sam Malone, is now in his 70s. Yet, even after nearly 50 years in the business, the passion that fuels Ted's love of his craft shows no signs of subsiding. As he says, "I think the thing that has given me any degree of career longevity comes from the fact that I love going to work. When I started acting, I didn't think, am I going to make it? Can I support myself? Will I have a career? Will I be famous? I just wanted to do the next scene with the next scene partner." Ted acknowledges that he still struggles with the darker elements of the business, such as insecurity, ego, hypocrisy, and fear. But turning them into strengths is the key. As he says, "Shame and guilt are some of my favorite motivators in life. If you're about to step in front of a camera and you don't have some nerves, you're usually headed for a really bad performance. You want that adrenaline pump because it keeps you sharp." These days, Ted's dealing with the very essence of good and evil in NBC's The Good Place, opposite Kristen Bell. The show explores the consequences of using a point-based evaluation system to sort people into the good place or the bad place. And it's as entertaining as it is unique, which is exactly how Ted likes it. His motto is to find the most creative person in the room and ask them very nicely if you can be part of whatever they're doing, because that way you stand a chance of being in something authentic and original. Ted joins off camera to talk about why Sam Malone scared the crap out of him, about finding a great partner in wife and fellow actress Mary Steenburgen, and how a simple, hey, can speak volumes if you do it just right. So pull up a chair and listen in.
Hi, Ted.
Hi, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
I'm sitting here going, how do I sit in this chair?
Well, it's an acquired skill, sitting.
I'll lock in a minute.
Good. It is nice to have you here. I grew up watching on TV, and I've so enjoyed, obviously, Cheers and Curb Your Enthusiasm. I love, and your Fargo performance, and now The Good Place. I just think you have this amazing body of work. And, you know, I started watching The Good Place, and it's really a show about the most confounding questions about life, life and death, heaven and hell, morals, ethics, and yet it's also absurd, and it seems to fit your sense of humor. And I guess I wanted to start by asking, what drew you to the project and sort of struck you as different?
Mike Schur.
Yeah.
The writer, creator. My motto is find the most creative person in the room, ask them very nicely if you can be part of whatever they're doing, because that way you stand a chance of being in something authentic and original and different, as opposed to somebody coming and saying, I have a great idea for you, Ted. That rarely works.
Right.
The creative process needs to start with the writer who just has this scream that they have to get out and just have to write. Because then it's going to be, you know, really interesting, as opposed to trying to guess what somebody else wants, you know.
I think that what's interesting is, if you start watching this show, you start thinking about your own little inconsequential actions throughout the day. Because the premise of the show is there's a point system that you get certain points for doing something good and points taken away for doing something bad, and that sort of determines your entrance into the good place or the bad place. And I would imagine that doing a show like this couldn't help but spark some conversations, or some of those things would rub off on your own thinking out in the world.
For me, it's more like seeing my hypocrisy.
Really?
Know? I mean, I watch myself to this day. I'll go, don't do it. Just when you put a tip in a jar for the barista, who then is turning his back away from you at the moment you're putting in this celebrity $20 bill, you know, kind of tip, and they're not seeing it, it's like, well, shoot.
Should I pull it out and do it again?
Yeah. So I wait.
You do?
I have waited, you know, which is a total karmic wash. Meaning no points for being generous, because you weren't really being generous. You were being, you know, self-aggrandizing kind of moment. So I have plenty of those in my life where I'm pretty much recognized as a nice guy.
Yes.
Well, if you go around being a nice guy, you got to figure at least 50% of that's for show. You know, 50% of that is your ego. 50%, you know, you're not always being nice. You're being something. Charming. You want to be charmed. You want to charm somebody.
And that's about you.
And that's about
me.
So whatever nice thing I'm doing at that same moment is a wash.
It's so funny. You know, when you think about the career you've had and how blessed you are to have been able to work with these creative geniuses. And I wonder if it ever makes you stop and go, why do I get to be... Like, do you ever have those sort of things, like, why do I...
I had a moment where, years after Cheers ended, went, I was the guy who got to play Sam Malone.
Yeah.
That's amazing, you know. I don't. You know, here's why. It's like, it is mysterious. I have a really great manager, and I've had a series of amazing agents and publicists, and but I really believe that I also have really great angels. You know, because it's like, who knows? I don't sit there and have a pile of scripts. I've never been the guy who goes, well, let me read all of this and make a choice. You know, I don't. What's next seems to appear for me. But I do believe that there's also a degree of the law of attraction. So you put out, you know, this and you usually get it back. So if you're sitting there going, it's so hard to get work around here, then the universe goes, oh, he's enjoying so hard to get work around here, as opposed to, man, I loved going to work, which I do. So I'm putting that out. And I'm guessing that that has an impact to some degree. You know, I'm not showing up and whining. I'm showing up and going, wow, which is probably a fun thing to, more fun thing to be around than a whiner. And if you start thinking you'd get it because you deserve, or you try to figure out what you're doing to make that happen, you're back into the negative points in the good place.
Right.
So you have to go to gratitude. You just have to go, thank you.
I think about that subconscious voice in our heads that tells us, oh, you didn't get that because of that, and you did get that because of that. And I wondered if, you know, when you were coming up, if you did have those sort of battles in your head about why you would or
why did that
why you would or not get
it?
Yeah.
Why
yeah.
didn't I get it? From the moment that light bulb went off and I was in a audition for a play, and it was the first time I was around theater folks and actors, it was like, wow, life makes sense.
Oh, really?
Oh my God. And all I cared about was the was acting. I was fascinated by it. I loved it. You know, and you never know why. First off, you never know why you don't get. You know, you look like their cousin who they hate. You're not better one day than you were the next. All of a sudden, you're a better actor than you were the day before when you didn't get anything. So it's a kind of a pointless exercise. You know, your job is to keep putting it out there and show up excited and grateful and work on it and do your best job. And, you know, something lands or it doesn't, and you'll never know. So trying to figure it out or a point blame is probably pointless.
Now, in terms of judgment, are you somebody who can you still be hard on yourself? Like to this day?
Yes, yeah, totally. I think from the moment I saw myself, my first film was The Onion Field. First time on a big screen. I was sitting there at the premiere and I went lower and lower in my seat in tears because I was not Cary Grant. I was just Ted. It was just me. And when I was performing, I was, I don't know, Olivier, Cary Grant, somebody. You know, I was astounding in the moment. And then I saw it and I was like, fuck. You know, I'm
really?
Not Matt Damon. Fuck Matt Damon. Sorry.
No, it's fascinating that you say that because I think that idea of what's happening in your head versus what's happening later when you actually see it, the difference. I'm sure.
I mean, what happens to me nowadays, what's going on is you know, I run around with people half my age on the playing field of acting, and I'm one of the kids. I'm one of the 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, you know, and then I sit down, turn it on, and I watch, and it's like, oh, fuck, I'm 70. Oh, no, I'm 70. I was pretending to be 70. I was going along with the thought that I was 70, but I was amusing people with my, you know, no, I'm 70, shoot.
Yeah, I certainly don't feel my age inside at all. And I don't feel a difference when I'm running around with our young crew and stuff. But
they're,
I also
they're
don't
all smirking, by the way. I looked up, they're smirking.
That's right. They're like, oh, he's old.
Yeah, the old guy thinks he's
Although
good.
I'm looking pretty good today. I'm looking pretty
you
young.
You are looking really good.
But I think that, so tell me about when you're sinking down in your seat and you're crying. What did you think was going to happen when people saw just Ted up there on the screen?
Here's the process for me. I'm in something. I watch it. I sob. It's horrible. And usually I'm sobbing because my nose or my ear or my neck or my something is just, it's, I'm just not a movie star. It's, something is just horribly wrong when I watch it. But I'm usually just stuck on something myopic. And the other thing is, when you watch acting, usually when you watch somebody else, why you love it is because you're surprised, you're delighted. I didn't see that coming. Oh my gosh, look what that person did. That's amazing. You look at yourself and you go, saw that coming, because you were there and you did it. So it's like, you're not surprising me at all, Ted, kind of feeling. But then the second time I'll watch it, I'll go, well, I guess it's not that bad, you know. And then the third time I go, oh, look, there are other actors in this scene with me. You know, I don't even see them until then. It's like, oh, they're all very good. But it takes me that long.
Is there something that happens when you stumble across something you did years ago where there's enough distance between that you're not that guy anymore? And can you see it like it's another
actor? Yes, I laugh my ass off at Cheers now.
You do?
Yes, especially at my friends, but I'm good in it. I think also people work from different places, like Mary, my wife, Mary Steenburgen. Mm-hmm. Wonderful, astounding actor, Academy Award winning actor, the real deal, an actress. She works from the joy of sharing. She'll have people come, come watch, come to the, come. I come from deep, deep shame. I work from shame. So it's like, no, don't come watch me work. Oh, Lordy, no.
Where does that come from?
I have no idea. I think shame and guilt are some of my favorite motivators in life. I love shame. I love comedy that comes out of a deep place of sadness. Sam Malone was an alcoholic. I liked that. I liked that if you're doing something heavy like Damages, I like that it's so heavy that it's funny. I like that, you have both. But for comedy, I love if it comes from a place of human frailty or angst or anger or sadness or something that balances just jokes, just funny.
When you say that shame is a great motivator, I relate to that. I think fear is a great motivator for me.
Sure. People talk about nerves before you go on. If you ever start something, you're about to step on a stage or in front of a camera, and you don't have some nerves, you're usually headed for a really bad performance or a bad moment. You want that edge of fear. You want that adrenaline pump.
Right.
Because it does keep you sharp.
And does that still happen 40 years into your career or whatever?
Sure.
It does.
Now what's chasing me is time and age and energy. So I go, I love going to work. I still want to be able to do this. I want to be a player. So I'm looking forward to exploring what it means to be 70. What is a guy supposed to be like when he's 70? What are you doing? Are you a mentor? Why are you here? What do you get,
Right. Well, I want to ask you about your upbringing, because when I started to read about you, I had no idea that you grew up in Arizona as the son of, your dad was a...
Archaeologist, anthropologist, and then a museum director.
So I was curious about your father's job and your economic standing as a family, as a kid, and how that sort of set your work ethic, I guess.
He, at 17, 18, went to Arizona, fell in love with Arizona, knew he wanted to be there the rest of his life, fell in love with anthropology, archaeology, and later in life as a museum director. He never made more than $10,000 a year. Had a car given by the museum, had a house to live in, but he never, and my mother was anti-materialistic. So we lived in this kind of we were not rolling in money, but I went away to a prep school in Kent, Connecticut. They were able to do that. And the cool thing about how that informed me was money's not an issue. And it's not the point of life either. And if you need it, it will show up somehow. So focus on the joy you can find in life doing something, and the money will be fine. Don't worry about it. Somehow it will come. So stay focused on what it is you want to do, and just do that. Don't worry about it. Was the kind of imprint that I got as a child, which has served me incredibly well.
And your dad, was he someone who really took an interest in your moral character and made sure that you were raised.
I think probably my mother was in charge of moral character.
Oh, really?
And church and spirituality and being nice and sensitive and kind. But my mother was, she had trouble with dark, the dark side of life, the human anger, petty, jealousy, all of those things. She judged herself very harshly when that would come up. So I was great at being kind, generous, supportive, caring, whatever, that kind of stuff. But I've always had trouble allowing the dark in my life, in my humanness, to coexist equally.
Because it's scary?
Yeah, way too anger, gosh. Here's how my wife Mary knows if I'm angry. She'll say, are you angry? Are you angry at me? And I'll go, no. And we'll go, oh, oof. Boy, is he angry.
Really?
Once I say no, we both, okay. Admitting that I'm angry at somebody.
What if you're actually not angry? What do you say?
That is clear. It's all right. It's clear. And I can say no. I can tell her, no, I'm sorry. I'm off thinking about this. Forgive me. No, I'm not. But if it's no, I'm furious. So, you know, I have trouble with that.
And was your dad a silent
like, my dad, my dad didn't do that. My mother handled the emotional side of the family.
Right.
He was more bluster and, oh, that's stupid. Oh, Jessica, my mother's name. Oh, don't be Jessica. Oh, you know, so I looked at him and went, well, that's kind of stupid. I don't want to be, oh, blah, blah, blah. So I was, and I adore my father, and he was miraculous in many ways, but he was not, he didn't show up emotionally in the family. He kind of abdicated that to my mother. I think my family was complicated to me emotionally. There were undercurrents that I didn't understand. And so I think it was, I'll be outside. I'll go play with my imaginary friends or my trucks that talk to each other or playing Cowboys and Indians by myself. You know, I was out in the desert in Tucson, you know, looking at snakes eat desert rats right in front of me, or, you know, I was in nature constantly. And because of my father's love of archaeology, anthropology, and the sciences, I was surrounded by people who would show me nature and eagles and this and that, you know, and take me on nature walks. And then later, when I moved up to Flagstaff, I had a friend, all my friends were either Hopi or Navajo or sons or daughters of ranchers, and we lived way outside of Flagstaff. So I'd jump on a horse and disappear all day and come back in time for dinner. It was a miraculous way to grow up. But the acting thing, I think, came out of my fantasy, let's keep it light, let me make you laugh, let's not get too serious here because I'm finding it a little confusing. That probably was fertile ground for somebody to become an actor.
And were you that kid among your friends too?
That came a little later.
Yeah.
But I do remember on playgrounds finding the strongest, scariest, biggest bully and then go make him laugh.
Really?
Yeah. It was always a safe way to go. I found him. Find the scared people and get them laughing.
So what was your plan in high school? What were you going to do for a living?
No, I was faking it. I was always over my head. I was not a great student. So I faked my way basically through my formal education until I found acting. I literally was, it was over my head. I tested well because I don't think I cared the same way someone who is a true academic cares. I always somehow managed to, you know, I went from Kent to Stanford, but literally when I was at Stanford University, I'd be in an English, advanced placement English class because I had tested well. And I'd listen to the professor talk and go, I have no idea what he's saying.
Really?
And not only that, I don't know what the student sitting next to me, I don't even know what that question meant. I was just whoosh, over my head. When acting came along, it was like, oh, thank you, God.
And how did it come along?
A young lady named Beth, who was working in the freshman dorm cafeteria, who I thought it'd be nice to be able to go out with. And finally got the nerve to ask her and for a cup of coffee. And about 5 minutes into the cup of coffee, she went, oh, shoot, I have an audition. I want to be with Beth, so can I come? I guess. And so off we went. But to stay in the room, you had to do something, audition. So I made something up. And I heard people laugh, and I was like, And I got the smallest part you could get and still be in the play. It was a Bertolt Brecht play, Mann ist Mann. And I was the, you know, fifth spear carrier or rifle carrier from the left, and was just smitten by this tribe of gypsies. There was, girls were smoking and swearing, and you changed together into your costume backstage, and it was all just like, oh my gosh, look at this. You know, it was just heaven. And I quit everything, even the pretense of going to school, and just pulled my station wagon up behind the little studio theater and just lived in the back of my station wagon.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, no, literally. And then people said, well, if you're this serious, you should go back east. So then I transferred to Carnegie Mellon.
Based on the experience of the one spear thrower number five, you were just, those are your people, and you
Smith.
Knew.
Yeah.
And did you ever, from that point, did you
and
have
I
plan B?
And I started taking classes, and no. The thing that I think has given me any degree of longevity that may come from the fact that I love going to work, truly love going to work, is that I fell in love with the process. I loved acting, so I didn't think, am I going to make it? I didn't think, can I support myself? Will I have a career? Will I be famous? Will I anything? I was just wanted to do the next scene with the next scene partner, you know, whatever it was. I just wanted to be part of that acting.
So how old were you when you got Cheers?
34.
So you struggled along and bounced around at auditions for a long time.
Yeah.
Did you eventually end up in New York? And
I went from Carnegie thinking I'd go to regional theater because that's what they, you know, repertory companies, that's what they prepared you for. It was like a classical training. And no one got into any of the repertory companies that year in my class, so we all headed to New York. And I kicked around for about 7 years. But the first month or two I was there, I got an understudy job in the greatest play you could probably have gotten for me, which was a Tom Stoppard 2-1 act called After Magritte and The Real Inspector Hound. It was off Broadway, and I was an understudy, but then people started to leave or want months off, so I was performing every night, one of two or three different characters.
So you were working pretty quickly, right, after you got
there?
Yeah,
you know, $125 a week.
Right.
Take the costumes home, and my then wife, Randy, and I would wash all the costumes and bring them back, you know, on our day off. So we were multitasking for not a lot of money, but I would audition for commercials. I would audition to be an extra, anything to get in front of a camera. I didn't care if I was an extra or a, didn't matter.
Describe that time. Did you have periods where you had other jobs and?
No, I was always able to get a commercial, and then I got a soap opera, which was huge money at the time. So I was always able to support myself with acting and the occasional stretch of unemployment.
It seems like you didn't skip any steps either. Like, you did the commercials, you did the soap opera, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It didn't, because when you think about
it. I was not an overnight success.
Right.
No. I always feel like someone's looking after me. I get just enough for me to be able to handle it. You know, I think my fame as my celebrity, my whatever, walk around persona is just enough that I can deal with it.
Did you ever get discouraged or lose belief that this was going to be a thing?
No, never. Never as a student and as a starting out. But it wasn't lose faith that it was going to happen because I didn't have because it's going to happen in mind. I wanted to succeed, and I couldn't get arrested in theater, and it would discourage me, and I'd be, oh, no, there was discouragement about, you know, not getting hired or this or that, but I still had my acting class to go back to. I was, you know, I don't think I had a dark night of the soul when it came to acting, and I'm sure my self-esteem did this, but it never did this to the point where maybe I need to find something else.
Were you ever worried you're getting these commercials and maybe they're feeling, I don't know, like beneath you? Did you ever worry, like, is that gritty I don't know,
yeah,
mean streets New York actor thing going to elude me. No, you didn't ever have
No, I mean, I admire people who did, you know, totally admire the authentic New York actor, you know, who stuck to their guns and, you know, totally admire it. But I've always had this, oh, if I take this, it's the end of my career, fuck you. I'm taking it. It's like, no, I will end my career, not you. I do believe that. If you allow yourself to sit in a typecast moment, typecast is brilliant. It means something you did was successful enough that people go, oh, that's who that person is. So that's a good thing. Now, if you stay there and don't do anything else, or keep doing the same thing because it worked, that's on you. So keep looking for something different as opposed to having things developed for the Ted Danson, Sam Malone guy.
Well, let's talk about that, because I do think it's interesting that you got that role. I mean, you were mid-30s, and you weren't just a kid. You've been doing this a long time.
Right.
But I was curious about this idea that Sam Malone was a certain type of arrogant, overconfident.
Womanizing,
and maybe some of these things that you weren't. If that was kind of overwhelming at the beginning.
It was.
Tell me about
that.
I mean,
the process wasn't overwhelming because we had no idea how, I think, lucky we were in the moment. We had Les and Glenn Charles and a room full of writers that were the pedigrees, you know, went back to I Love Lucy just about. They were some of the brightest and best at a half hour, you know, ever. And you had Jimmy Burrows, who was, you know, Jimmy Burrows, who went on to be Jimmy Burrows, you know.
Yeah.
He is the god of all half hour as far as, you know, creating and directing. So we were so bathed in this creative love and process and brilliance that there wasn't a lot of worry about that. When I saw myself for the first time, when I saw the pilot, I did my TED trick of, you know, Jimmy, can I talk to you? Yeah. I saw the pilot, and I'm terrible. You know, I was crying. I was horrified at how bad I was
really?
In the pilot. Yes, he took 2 seconds and went, what? And then started laughing and walked away. So here's what I saw that I didn't like, and it took me a year and a half to get. Because I didn't have that arrogance in me. I didn't know that. I didn't know the bar guy. I never went to bars. I never picked up somebody.
Now, is that true? You're bumping around New York for a dozen years?
No, I would do my attempt at it, but I was married. I showed up married. At age 22, I got married at Carnegie, and we both showed up together, and the real communication probably would have been, hey, I'm scared to go to New York. We're best friends. Let's go together and share a place and hold each other's hands. Probably was the emotional truth of the moment, but we ended up getting married and went there. So we were like best friends, probably not husband and wife material, but best friends. And where did I go? Why did I go in this direction? Shoot, and whenever I mention an ex-wife, my eyes will start to cross and I'll get lost.
No, you were talking about how arrogant guy and that you never went to bars.
Okay, so right, never went to bars. Didn't pick me. You know, if the woman was standing opposite me, buck naked, I'd go, oh, me?
You'd go like this.
Yeah. Oh, good. How wonderful. Literally. So I didn't know arrogant. I didn't know relief pitcher, which is the height of arrogance. I'm going to come in at the last second and save this game because I'm that good. You know, I'm the bartender who everyone comes to. I had none of that.
And you owned the place.
And I owned the place. And it took me about a year of realizing, oh, millions of people are watching me and they're judging you. And they're, you know, they're judging you more than you're judging yourself, Ted. So, and you're not going to be able to please them. So lighten the fuck up and enjoy the moment. And that was a shift. It was like, oh, the kind of arrogance that somebody in the public light, maybe arrogance is not the right word, but you need to be able to go, fine, judge away, I don't really care. Or have your opinion, you're welcome to it, but I'm going to do my thing, is a degree of arrogance. And that's when I started to relax into that character, after about a year and a half.
At the beginning, were you afraid that you couldn't pull that off?
Sure. Every time they wrote something where I had to come on to somebody in the bar, which was a lot, it was like, oh, so embarrassed. I would sweat.
Yeah,
because can I tell you my first job is on a soap opera?
Yeah.
This is before, when I was still in New York, they hired me to be the town coxman, and I was supposed to be, you know, really just on fire. And so I sit down on day one, having had a Valium the night before, because I was having a mild nervous breakdown of, oh my God, someone hired me, I have to perform. And so I don't do well on Valium. So I'm pouring sweat, just sheets of sweat. And I'm playing opposite and picking up this, hitting on this woman who'd been on the show for months and was a regular and at ease. And I was sitting there trying to be like really cool, sweat. And the producer went, no, he's not a leading man. We'll make him the town sleaze who turns all his friends into the mafia. Yeah. So anyway, it took me a while to be that guy. I learned on Cheers, I learned to keep my mouth shut when people said, wow, Sam Malone is this sexy character. I'm dying on the inside and terrified and unbelievable as a man about town, to me. But I learned to keep my mouth shut and just let the fact that beautiful women were being hired to be on the set in the show saying, oh my God, Sam Malone is so sexy. I learned to keep my fear to myself.
Your impulse was to say no.
No, geez, are you kidding? You know, kind of thing. And I learned to shut up and finally allow that.
It's funny you mentioned leading man, because it is a question of are you born with that or can you learn that? And do you think at heart you were more of a character actor?
Oh, 100% I'm a character actor. I say that with some ego attached because I like the idea of a character actor. You know, Robert Duvall was my hero, you know, growing up in acting. Let me add to that. I think that if you're going to hire somebody to play Sam Malone, who is a jock and an arrogant jock, he's so good, an actor I'm talking about, and who's a, you know, great with women. It's a rare combination where that actor, and there are some that we can, let's not say Matt Damon. I think you need to get the joke of being a womanizer. If you are a womanizer so much, or a man about town or whatever, that you don't get that it's kind of funny, then it's going to be hard to play Sam Malone. I think you need to get the joke that there is a degree of horseshit in there.
Right. Know?
There's a human frailty in there that if you are willing to take a look at the human frailty of being macho, that's funny. Now you can have fun.
And that's what Cheers had. Cheers had that. I mean, you know, it's funny with television, especially in that era when there were only a few things to watch. You were in people's living rooms on a weekly basis, being extremely relatable, and you're not really this person, but every single person on earth that watches Cheers thinks you're that person. And I would imagine that that would have been really confusing or weird to sort of have to always assume every room you walked in, every person you met, they were assuming you were a different person.
I have to say, being able to walk by a bunch of drunk bar sports guys and be considered one of them because of their impression of who Sam Malone was kind of cool. You know, still am floating off of Cheers. I still get to go into places that I wouldn't have the courage necessarily to go into and meet people and hang with people and enjoy people who I might not have, who I would have been too afraid to be around necessarily because I'm not like that. It's been a great ambassadorship. Can you imagine? By and large, I get to walk around with people being nice to me. It's amazing. Really is.
And I totally understand that, but I would think that there would be some pitfalls to that as well.
Oh, of course. Yeah, of course. So you want to go dark?
I do. How do you live that out in the world when everyone who sees you and comes in contact with you?
I have a generic response to the bar, passing by the bar, or the guys, or the whoever. It's not always the guys. It's whoever. But I don't quite have time to stop, and I didn't really hear exactly what they said or meant. Here's my generic response. Hey, it works miracles.
That's it? I was waiting for this great piece of wisdom.
No, you try it, man. I know it seems small and it, you know, not big, but you walk by going, hey, you can keep walking. And they go, yeah, he totally got that because he went, hey. I know this is sounding.
That's your big secret.
Okay, Sam. I think I'm not fooling myself. I'd hate to think that I am, but no, it truly works. A generic, sweet, hey, I'm with you, brother. I totally know what you just said, and man, are you right. All comes out in that, hey.
Just hey. Just hey. That's it.
No. Hey.
You have to draw it out a little
bit. You have to draw it out like, oh, man, if I could only stop and talk to you. Oof.
You know what? There is some subtlety to that, hey.
There'll be a time, maybe a few years from now, when you and I bumped into each other at a party.
Am I going to get
the
hey?
And you're going to get a hey. And you're going to go, oh, fuck.
I'll be like, that arrogant asshole. I just got this hey. I'm going to go talk to Matt Damon instead.
Hey, I'm a bundle of fears. I'm a bundle of dark, scary thoughts. I'm a bundle of not living up to that guy is what you're acting. And I went through a lot of stuff. You know, I didn't grow up emotionally. And if I hadn't worked really hard on myself in my early 40s, my wife, Mary Steenburgen, wouldn't have even seen me.
Let's talk about that, because I find your marriage to her, from what I know of it, beautiful. And I was reading about it, and I got the sense from whatever I was reading that you both had sort of given up on finding love right before you met each other.
Yeah.
What was your mindset right before you?
I don't know about finding love, but being capable of not messing up a relationship.
Okay.
And I was such a mess when I met her. I had about a year and a half where I was like, whoa. And I worked really hard. I mean, therapy and clinics and everything.
You're referring to your whole public, the whole mess of the Friars Club and all that.
All of the above, all of the above. That was, all of that was like this. What I was dealing with was.
Really?
Yeah, privately. I misbehaved terribly in my second marriage. And I, at one point, decided I wanted to stop being a liar. I wanted to spend most of my life, 90% of my life, being creative. And I came back and really wasn't like a clear trajectory, but it was, I really worked very hard to get in touch with me and what made me tick and why and all the stuff, you know, that one is supposed to do in their 20s, I was doing in my 40s. And it was dark and hard, and I mean, clearly life is an ongoing process, and I'm still working on all of this stuff. But I did make a shift that allowed me, you know, to start telling the truth, being more real. And in that moment, I met Mary Steenburgen. And you know, you can't assign something you did to make that work. You have to really, without being too airy-fairy, say that it was divine. There was something divine there.
Did you feel, right before you met her, almost like, because of the way you had lived your life, that you didn't really deserve that kind of love anymore, or?
I don't think I knew, you know, because what is love is basically your capacity to be whole, you know. There's love all the way through life, but I mean, and we all hopefully grow and all of that. And what's growing is your ability to love, but, which means you have to see all your dark crap and your every, you know, you have to see yourself as holy as possible. And the more holy you know yourself, all of the horrible stuff and the good stuff, the more you're able to love, clearly. I mean, it just makes sense. If I'm only allowing myself to see this much of myself, that's all I can give. So I think I had started that process of opening myself up so that I could love. I cannot imagine, when I met Mary, I didn't even imagine how much love was going to come my way, an ability to love was going to come my way. I mean, that's also the trick. Find someone who's willing to look at themselves as honestly. You know, so if you're both looking at yourselves honestly, then you'll trust the other person that if you open up and go, man, am I a mess up, this is what I just did in that moment to you, that they will go, well, thank you, and this is what I did to you. Because if the other person isn't going to open up, then you're going to go, well, no, that's too vulnerable. I ain't going to grow around that person because I'll get smashed. You need to find somebody who's playing the same game, and Mary and I were blessed that way.
Was there something that made you feel like, oh, this is something I haven't experienced
before? Well, I'll tell you, in the day I met her on a film where the director got us together for a dinner to see whether we were compatible or whatever. I don't know what it was, but I remember being totally smitten. I remember looking at her. Usually, if you're around a beautiful woman, but there's no introduction or no, I look at beautiful women peripherally. It's like, but as soon as, either because I'm embarrassed or whatever, I don't have that, you know, guy thing. But now I'm supposed to act with this person. So I have carte blanche to look this person in the face and in the eyes.
That's funny.
And at dinner, I was just, oh my God, look at her. She had like this, you know, 1,000-watt bulb going off behind her eyes. She was so light and so interesting. And then
at the same time, when you're saying that, I can't help thinking, like, there's got to be some Sam Malone in that, too, in terms of the periphery and not really looking. And there's got to be some awareness, too, of, oh, this woman thinks I am that guy. Like, did you?
I didn't know that. She told me that.
Did she think that?
She said, oh, I love this script, but Ted Danson's attached to it, and he's that Hollywood slick Sam Malone kind of guy. And I think I've proven, even in this interview, that I ain't that guy. I wish I were. I wish I were Matt Damon. yeah, but she says, the first time she kind of looked at me differently, it was we were in a lunch line, and I had just started to paint. In my self-discovery, I was carrying around my my watercolors or oil colors or whatever they were, and painting. Whenever I had a break, I'd sit down and paint. So I had spattered with paint, and my rear end, my Levi's, had a tear in it by the pocket, so that the pocket flap was all the way down, and you could see my, as she said, tidy whiteys. And she went, "Well, this guy's not cool. He's a doofus. This is interesting. Now I'm interested."
So she also had a misperception of who you were.
Yeah. That night that I met Mary in the restaurant for the Will They Get Along meeting with the director, I told her my life. I mean, all first off, they were new discoveries. I went, oh my gosh, this is who I am. Holy moly. This is where I've been. This is who I am. This is who my parents are. You know, I went wham! And to the point where she was thinking, oh dear Lord, please. Too much information. You shouldn't be saying this out loud, kind of stuff. So I had nothing to hide, including my butt. You know,
your tidy whities.
My tidy whities. I had nothing to hide. So I wasn't trying to prove. I had already proved to myself that I was a hot mess. So I wasn't trying to prove anything to somebody. It was really kind of a. I think for both of us, there was this even playing field, a sense of calm, you know, which probably allowed the magic, the divine, the whoever, you know, that allowed us to get together.
Yeah. Was there a freedom to that, too, with work, of being able to let go of that and say, because you mentioned just for a second earlier, when I was thinking about that time after Becker, and maybe there was one other show that you did that went for one season or something like that.
If that, I can't remember, but yeah.
But it was just before Curb Your Enthusiasm, and I wondered if that was a time where you had the most trepidation about, or the most concern about whether your career would keep going.
That moment you're referencing after, you know, 18 years of half-hour sitcoms, I felt I had stayed too long at that half-hour sitcom party, and that other people were doing it way better than I was. I was not finding myself funny, and the show lasted, you know, half a season. And so I went, oh, I'm out. I called Jeffrey Katzenberg, who was a friend because of Three Men and a Baby, and said, I don't want to do TV anymore. I'm not doing, I want to go back to movies and films. Can you get me into anything? You don't have to pay me. I don't care. I just want to start making movies again. And that led to, pretty sure, Saving Private Ryan, which was 2 days on this magnificent film. But I felt like I, you know, I felt a lot of doubt.
You
and
did?
Then, yes, and then Curb Your Enthusiasm came along, Larry David, who I thought I was doing a favor because his pilot sucked. You know, I was like, Mary and I both in Martha's Vineyard, invited to come see the pilot, and it's hot, and we're all sweaty, and a couple of people fell asleep. Mary and I went, oh, Larry, any time you want us to come on the show as ourselves, we'd love to, poor sap, you know, help you out. And, you know,
and we'll never have to,
yeah, actually. And it changed my life. It really did. Going off and doing that show, besides it's brilliant, and he turned half hour on its ear. It also brought happiness. It brought a giggle back to my work. All of a sudden, I was enjoying going to work, and I was laughing again. And that opened the door to Damages, and that opened the door to don't worry about the size of a part. Just get in the get into anything that's really creative and just be grateful and leave it at that. And that's when my career kind of had a second breath, was
yeah.
because of that. But let me go back to, I think you should start every, I do. I have a nervous breakdown before every part and a nervous breakdown at the end of every part. Because you, I think, my two cents about creativity is you need to start at zero every
like
time.
Like forgetting everything you've
you
learned.
You don't know squat. And if you think you do, you're wrong. And you're, you know, you need to start at zero. Because if you're starting on, oh, I know this worked and this last part I did, you know, you don't have anything to do with brand new creativity. You have to start at zero. You have to start at not knowing, which has to bring fear and anxiety and, you know, doubt and all of those things. But it should. I think that's what the creative process should be. You should start over every time.
Well, that's a good example of what Curb Your Enthusiasm was, because
yep.
you played yourself, or a version of yourself, and yep. it seems like it was sort of the perfect way to wipe the slate clean.
Yep, it did.
It's almost like when you play yourself, it was almost a way to tell the audience, I'm not that guy, right? For the first time?
I mean, yes, it was a reset. You're absolutely right.
And did you, was that, I don't want to say calculated, but were you sort of aware when that opportunity
no.
came along? Not at all, because, or did you have a desire to go, I want to do character stuff, and I want to...
Well, that was the phone call to Jeffrey Katzenberg. I don't want to do this anymore. I want to start over. You know, I don't think the Larry thing was more of a hoot and oh, why
right.
not? I had no idea how amazing it would be for me.
Was that a scary time?
Yeah.
Because I think about that episode on Cheers where you take the toupee off. And I also think about the first two or three seasons of Curb Your Enthusiasm where you have dark hair. And all of a sudden you come back the next season, you have white hair. And I am curious if those were moments where you just decided, I'm going to take a vulnerable step here and see if I can change the perception a little bit or change the game a little bit.
They came, the Cheers writers came to me and we knew it was the last season and it was going to be over and said, how do you feel about taking your hairpiece off? My little divot. And notice how I wanted you to know that it wasn't like a wig.
You didn't go like this with your hands. You just went like this.
I went, just a minor flaw. Quick minor flaw story. Height of Cheers, very rock and roll. We're in New York and we're being feted in this building and it's all like we are, and there are groupies following us, and this one girl in particular was just following me everywhere. At one point in the evening, we are coming down an escalator and she was going up or whatever. She had a vantage point at the back of my head, which was balding, you know, so it's like, and I heard her as she passed by and saw my bald spot, oh, burst my bubble. Don't know why I brought that up. Hey, I love laughing. I love comedy. I love being part of the joke. But the best material I have to work with is my human frailty. So laughing at myself is part self-defensive, I'm sure. But it also, Mary and I love laughing at each other, with each other, at our foibles. To me, that's just, once I get the joke about, if I'm struggling with something and I'm righteous and angry and da-da-da-da-da, you know, and then I, with Mary, without Mary, I get that I'm a fuck up and I messed up and boy, am I wrong. The next thing that happens is I'm tickled to death at what an idiot I am, which I think allows me, I'm not afraid to discover what an asshole I am, because I find it kind of funny. Whenever I get blown off my high horse, it's kind of funny. And I think that's where my humor lies. I'd rather make fun of how silly Ted Danson is, including hair pieces.
Even back then?
Yeah, I think I was, by then, this was the 11th year of Cheers that happened.
Right.
I think I was beginning to get the joke.
Well, it is interesting because beyond the joke or the image or anything, there is, I think for everybody, there is this, you know, this vulnerability or this fear that comes along with aging.
Yeah.
And having to face yourself in the mirror and you know, just that idea of going from, you know, dyeing your hair to not dyeing your hair. And yeah. I wonder if it's, you know, if that was a bit of an internal battle for you or if it was like, great, I just get to put all that away.
Oh, everything's an internal battle for me to some degree or another. I'm as vain as everybody, probably more so. I'm as this, you know, and I try to defang it because I don't want it to run my life, so I'll make fun of it or I'll call myself out because I'd rather call myself out than have you call me out and not and me be surprised by it. You know, all of these things are defense mechanisms, but my go-to defense mechanism is, you know, some degree of humility or false humility or something. I'd rather work with myself and make fun of myself, I think.
What surprised you when you just let that go? It's like, oh, I'm just gonna let my hair be white and...
Relief. Oh my God, relief. Every 10 days, sitting in some salon with the ladies, with tinfoil in my hair, you know, dyeing it, that's hard. That's really hard. Letting your hair go, it's easy. My go-to thought, which doesn't, I've said this to Mary and she goes, and other people don't quite get it, but my go-to comfort thought around fear is, and then you die. So if I succeed in whatever thing, you know, that's causing me to be fearful, if I all of a sudden have long, flowing, gorgeous hair, and then I die, you know, or don't, and then I die. So who cares? You know, don't get stuck on some fearful thing.
I was wondering if Mary was a catalyst for that, of if you sort of see when you met her as a place also where there's a strength to...
Oh, of course. I mean, first off, she insists on being real whenever I'm phony or, you know... most of our fights or arguments or disagreements are me not being real. And usually it comes in with, I have a fear or a dark or an angry thing that I'm not willing to allow. So I come in faking that I'm in a great mood or I'm very happy or I'm with you. No, I'm totally with you. And I'm not. That's when, you know, so she is always, she's, you know, I'm sure I'm a great partner for her too, but man, does she, my growth as a human runs through Mary, you know.
Ah, that's beautiful. Really do seem to have a beautiful marriage.
If you were to tune in to the hidden cameras in our house, you know, we're as silly.
Well, I did. That's how I know all this stuff.
So you know how silly and stupid we are. So I don't hold us up as some great example, but I will say that whatever.
You should wear clothes more around the kitchen and bathroom areas too, you know.
Oh, no, it's reached the point where I do. I don't walk around naked anymore.
Really? Is that
like,
is that
like flowing
byproduct of turning 70?
Flowing caftans. So I don't have to bump into a mirror.
Well, I want to, before we finish up, give you a compliment and also tell you the scene that I think you did that's my favorite moment of your acting career. There's a scene near the end of the season of Fargo. You play a police officer, and you have a daughter and a granddaughter, and it's the scene where she's telling you that when you weren't home, she sort of rifled through your office, and she came across something, and it was strange, and she didn't understand it, and you're sort of, you're embarrassed, but you're also open and honest, and you start telling her that since your wife died, you didn't know what to do with yourself, and you started thinking about how people can't communicate with each other. And most of the violence in the world comes from the fact that we just don't have the right words to really communicate. And the gist of the story is that you're up there creating your own language. And as you're saying this, it's dawning on you in your expression that to anyone, this would sound absurd. And it's this combination of acceptance and embarrassment and a desire to be honest with your daughter. And you finish telling her, and there's a pause, and she looks at you and she says, "You're a good man." And you say, "Well, I don't know if I'm a good man, but I like to think I have good intentions." And it is, first off, as a father, it's the kind of moment you always want. Yeah. If you could just have your adult daughter tell you you're a good man. But it's also this incredibly beautifully complex scene about human vulnerability, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. And that scene gets me every time, and I wonder if in your heart of hearts, if you could have played a scene like that without going through what you've been through, the nuance of that, and if that, and I don't know if I'm barking up the wrong tree or if that scene meant something to you as an actor.
No, it did.
Well.
It did indeed. It was a beautiful scene. I think it's a combination of everything. I mean, hopefully, the more you grow and. The more you grow, the more access you have to that growth when you act. Hopefully, you know, I mean, it's always 50-50 whether or not you're going to be in the moment. You either in that moment, literally in that moment, when the camera's rolling, or you're not. And, you know, you are either, sometimes you want to show how good you were, you want to repeat that last take that you did that was, that was really good, or I know it should be, you know, if you're anywhere other than being totally surprised in that moment about what's coming out of you, it doesn't work. It'll be all right, but there'll be a disconnect for the audience as opposed to looking at something that's happening in front of you for the first time. And that to me is like a 50-50 chance of it happening with me when cameras roll, at best. So that was one of those moments that I happened to be there, you know, in that moment. But it was beautiful writing.
Well, it's true. I don't think that those things really transfer if you're not there in that moment.
Yeah.
But when it happens, and like you said, when the
No, I love that moment, too. I'm actually, you know, I won't give you one of those, hey, next time I see you, because that I love that moment too, and thanks for, you know, talking about it.
Well, thanks for talking to me,
yeah.
And for being so open about your life, because you came here and I thought, I'm going to dispel this whole reputation that he's the nicest guy in the world. I'm going to, you know.
No, I got this act down, man.
You really
it's
do.
It's a hard nut to
you
crack.
You are impenetrable.
It's a hard nut to crack.
No, you really are a wonderful guy, and I've really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you for coming in.
You too. And it's a real, what you're doing is a really neat thing.
I appreciate that.
To have a conversation.
Thank you.
Is a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey folks, that's our show. And unless you're Matt Damon, you probably enjoyed that very much. I know I did, and for someone who's been in my television for so many years, it was a treat to talk to Ted and to find out what a funny and nice and honest guy he was.
You can see him right now on The Good Place, which airs on NBC. You can also find the entire Cheers archive on Netflix. And if you want to take a deeper dive into Ted's work, check out HBO's Bored to Death, Damages, and also Fargo. And of course, you can see him playing Ted Danson in Curb Your Enthusiasm, which is not to be missed. So I want to thank Ted, and I want to thank his wife, Mary, for letting him come down here and talk to us. That was a great hour. Hey, before you dive into all the hours of recorded television history with Ted Danson, take a minute and go over to offcamera.com. As you may know, besides being a podcast, we are also a TV show. You can find us on the Audience Network on DirecTV. If you don't have DirecTV, or if you want to see all of our episodes and dive deep into our archive, the best way to do that is with our television subscription. For only $4.99 a month, you can have access to every show we've ever made to watch on any device as many times as you like. It's a great deal, it's a great way to dive into the show, and it's a great way to support the show. And if you're loving the podcast, well, that's great. And we'd love for you to take a minute and tell people about it. One of the easiest and best things you can do is go to iTunes, subscribe to the show, and while you're there, give us a rating and review. Every time you do that, it helps more people find the show. The other thing you can do is talk about us on social media. And if you took a minute and shared with all your friends why you love this show and what it is about this show that's different, that would help us a lot too. And maybe you're lonely and you need to go on social media. So now you have something cool to talk about. We are Off Camera Show at Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And I am Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. So go out there, shout about the show, give us suggestions on who you want to see on the show, or just tell your friends. Hey, speaking of friends, I want to tell you about all the friends that help out on this show every week and make it possible. Crawford Shippey, Nathan Shields, Michaela Galvin, Sasha Snow, Kara Johnson, Bo Galvin, and Matt Davidson, who is whipping up a batch of his Christmas eggnog, which nobody really drinks. We kind of pour it out when he's not looking, but he tries really hard. So thank you to everybody who works on the show. And be sure to join me next time when I sit down with actress and writer Emily Mortimer.
I'm a naturally very shy person, very, very shy as a child, really cripplingly shy, so that I couldn't sort of hold my hand up in class without blushing. And I think I learned as a way of combating shyness that I had to kind of do the opposite. I had to really, like, go on stage and take off all my clothes or whatever in order to deal with it. It's like jumping out of an airplane or something. Everything in your body is telling you not to, but then the minute you jump, there's no going back, and there's an incredible freedom about that feeling of sort of free-falling. And then I think something quite magical happens.
Emily first came to my attention in Nicole Holof Center's Lovely and Amazing, specifically in an extremely vulnerable scene that captured the mindset of a struggling actress. What I found out in our conversation was just how much Emily was struggling with her own career at that time, and how that was a watershed moment for her, and one that also anointed her with a rather unfortunate catchphrase. But she came away from that experience with a new respect for her career and a desire to be in the moment, and that has defined her choices ever since, and led to nuanced performances in The Newsroom, Shutter Island, her newest film, Mary Poppins, and also Doll and M, her autobiographical series that she created, wrote, and starred in with her best friend, Dolly Wells. Doll and M is a nuanced look at what happens in Hollywood when friendships turn to business relationships, and it also provides scathing commentary about the film business itself and gives unparalleled insight into what it feels like to be an actress. Emily may be the bravest, scaredest person in the world, and that may be just what it takes to create great art. See you next time, off camera.